for the talk. Okay, so today I want to tell you a couple of different stories. So hopefully I can tell you a little bit about mechanisms and also tell you a little bit about coding. And because this is nominally a space, time, and learning meeting, I actually won't get a chance to talk about some learning, though we've done some work on learning in grid cells, but I'll try to talk at least about some space representation. Okay, so I'd like to begin with just this basic observation that the computational elements of the brain can be quite noisy. So neural spiking, this is the classic experiment and analysis by Sofke and Koch, and also Shadlin and Newsom on the variability in spike trains upon repeated stimulus. The trial-to-trial variance is, sorry?
Is that in vitro or vivo?
This is in vivo. Yeah, so trial-to-trial variance is high, and I think if, you know, your question may be getting at, you know, in vivo there might be other things uncontrolled for variability because of inputs to the system. And so, yeah, it's kind of debatable whether this kind of variability is really noise or whether it's, you know, some other inputs to the system. But, you know, how much ever we can argue about variability in spike trains, I think it's an inescapable fact that at least synaptic transmission appears to be really well fit by models that are just stochastic vesicle release contingent on the spiking of the presynaptic neuron. Okay, so these properties, you know, inherently will inject noise into whatever process or computation is being performed, and representations also in the system. Okay, so needless to say, sometimes perturbations and noise that are injected to a system can be problematic, and it's particularly true. It's particularly true if the computation that's being performed is recursive, right? So if the computation involves multiple steps or recursion. Based on the state, then that noise not only affects the instantaneous state, but it's also accruing over time. Okay, so that can be a problem. So then, that's sort of just by way of sort of motivation for some of the things I'm going to tell you. So then, before launching into the full story, I just want to also sort of start with some very basic observations about neural representation and persistent activity, things like that. So let's consider N neurons, okay? N neurons sitting around, and suppose they're completely uncoupled from one another. So just N neurons, individual neurons sitting there. So what is the state space? So the state space is defined as basically the space in which the activities of these neurons can reside. Okay, so for example, this is the firing rate of neuron 1, neuron 2, and neuron 3. They go from 0 to some R max, some peak maximum firing rate for each neuron. Okay, so the state space is big, right? It's n-dimensional. The n neurons is an n-dimensional state space, so it's this big hypercube. But the problem is that, you know, and this point in the state space then represents, you know, the activity of these neurons together. So maybe neuron R1 is firing at this rate, neuron R2 is firing at, I don't know, you project it down here, and neuron R3 is firing at some high rate, close to one up here. Okay, so that's the point in state space. And the problem with this picture, or with this form of representation not the problem with this picture, but the problem with using N individual neurons to represent something you might want to represent in the real world is that, you know, you might map points in the state space to values of some variable in the real world, but this representation has no memory, right? So the intrinsic persistence times of individual neurons is short. It's about order 10 to 100 milliseconds. So if you initialize the system in this state, it'll rapidly decay back to something close to the origin. The other point is that
are you talking about their intrinsic dynamics or their spike rate, or, you know,
this is for example, just each neuron is a simple leaky capacitor, okay, or something like that, right? Standard. I mean, most neurons don't individually have persistence, so it's an viewpoint. Okay, and then the second point is that this representation scheme would have no noise tolerance, right? So if a neuron has some variable amounts of spikes. Spiking activity, then if you put the system in a state and even try to, you know, keep it there, but then there's a lot of variability in individual neural responses, and so there's no mechanism for sort of correcting that kind of noise and so on. Okay, so then what's an idea to deal with this issue? So the point is that if you take this set of N neurons and strategically add recurrent connections between them, some lateral coupling, all right, then it's possible with special forms of that connectivity to create these special points in the state space, which are called fixed points. So these fixed points are states that are stable, and if you initialize the system in that fixed point, it'll stay in that vicinity of that fixed point. Okay, the problem is, right? So now you've got these states that can store some states, But you have taken a big hit in the representational capacity of the system, right? So you go from this big n-dimensional space, and now you just have something like, if they're n neurons, then they're order n states, okay? So Hopfield networks have a capacity of order n discrete fixed points. Okay, so the point is that you go from an n-dimensional representation to basically a zero-dimensional representation, or if you want to discretize the space in the first place, it was like, you know, the q states per neuron and the firing rates, and you go from something like q to the n states to something down to n states. So you've taken a big hit, right? But what are the gains that you have? Well, the one gain was that there's noise tolerance, okay? So each of these fixed points has some basin of attraction so that perturbations of that point decay spontaneously back to that point, and so small perturbations are immediately corrected away. So there's some noise resistance in this kind of scenario.
Sorry, okay. Is it always proportional to n?
It's order n, right? And so, well, that you can control, right? So they're order n controllable states. So if you want to build n specific state, if you want to build a specific set of states with learning rules that are like Hopfield, right? I should say that. So
yeah, yeah.
So normally the learning rules, right? So the other step is that within these Hopfield networks, there it's this prescription for how to generate these fixed points, right? Through some simple learning rules or associated learning rules and things like that.
You wanted to have a sizable basin of attraction also for error.
No, you can have sizable basin of attraction, but if you're synaptic matrix is not the Hopfield type. You can have n squared or n third.
That's right. That's right. Like in a spin glass, you can have very many fixed points, right? That are kind of.
You can even have more controllable fixed points.
I'm sorry.
You get more controllable fixed points with better scaling with
n. You can,
in
yeah.
I
don't know anyone who's built anything with something better than n that are controllable. So that would be a great.
What does controllable mean?
To put the fixed points where you want.
Yeah.
No, there's that whole theoretical.
Yeah, Pierre Baldi.
Yeah.
Which one?
The learning rule there.
Which
Pierre Baldi.
Pierre Baldi, when is this from?
Got a billion years ago.
Okay, so and how? What's the scaling that he gets with the controllable fixed points?
I mean, the idea is that if you have
n to the k.
N to the k is what?
In principle, pretty big. It's a little bit of side point, but in principle, pretty big.
No, I mean, that's a really interesting point for, you know, what I'm later going to talk about, actually. So the point is that I think there should be such systems, but
well,
it would be
too big, right?
I don't know. I mean, depends on what
you're doing. The amount of information you put in the synaptic matrix determines how many fixed points you have.
Yeah.
The Hopfield type of learning is kind of, in a sense, I mean, the good thing about it is that it's associative and it's.
That's right. That's right.
Learning. But there are other. I mean, there's other ways you can have more higher order interactions in your synaptic matrix. And that leads to higher, a different scaling of the.
So what, yeah, so I guess the question is, how big a scaling can you get? Can you get, so you
n
get
to
n to the k, so you get some polynomial.
If you have, I think, kth order correlations in your j.
Then you can get n to the k. Okay, so that's interesting. So can we actually return to that? Because that's very, very relevant when we come back to, because I'm not, the first part's gonna be dynamics, I'm not really gonna go there. But when we talked about coding, it's extremely relevant. So let's come back and have that discussion because that's one of the discussions I was really hoping to have today. So, okay, so the other advantage, right, of these fixed points is that they're stable states. They're fixed points, so there's persistence, right? So you initialize the system in the state, and it'll stay at least for some time in that state. You know, in the absence of noise, it'll stay forever, and in the presence of noise, it'll stay for some time. Okay, so they're able to hold a memory. These states become memory states. Okay, so now that was, you know, if that was if you wanted to hold a discrete number of variables. Now, what if you want to hold a continuum? Okay, so you want to hold a variable that's a continuous variable. Okay, in that case, you could imagine constructing some lateral connectivity between neurons that can lead to a set of fixed points that actually lie on a continuum. So then this becomes, this green circle is a continuous set of fixed points. It's also called a continuous attractor manifold. And this has the same advantages as, some of the same advantages as those discrete fixed points. So because it's a set of fixed points, then perturbations orthogonal to this manifold can again are spontaneously corrected by the dynamics, so they decay back onto this line over here, this ring. But on the other hand, you also have some non-correctability along the manifold, and we'll come to that. So, but again, you've taken this big hit in representational space over here. Okay, at the advantage of gaining memory and noise tolerance. Okay, so now these ideas, okay, so the ideas of these discrete attractors were proposed by Hopfield in the 80s, so it's been 30 years, three decades. This idea of continuous subtractors have been proposed a couple of decades ago by Kitchen and by Sebastian Sung and Ben Inishai and Sumpolinski. And so that's been two decades since continuous subtractor networks were sort of proposed as a way of storing states and even just building representations that have some noise tolerance. Okay, so they're really compelling, I think, abstract ideas. And, you know, the question though is, you know, I mean, do these ideas, are they anything beyond analogy? Is there a sense in which the brain really is constructing and using these kinds of fixed points and dynamics in its computations? Okay, so that was very abstract. Okay, so some of you already immediately see that picture and understand what neural circuits could give rise to it, but others may not. So I wanted to give you a very concrete and simple example of a neural network that could give rise to this continuum of fixed points. So this is probably the canonical example. This was first proposed by Kitchen Zhang on the ring model. Okay, and of course Benishai and Sumpolinski. So in this ring network, let's suppose that there's a set of neurons that you arrange on this 1D ring. You physically arrange them on a ring, and you design the connectivity so that each neuron excites its immediate neighbors, but then inhibits all the neurons further away from its immediate neighborhood. Okay, so it's global inhibition and local excitation. So this kind of connectivity is, and what I'm going to plot on the right side is going to be the state space of a pair of these neurons over here. So it'll be like something like R1 and R2. Okay, so this kind of connectivity, if it's strong enough, it causes the uniform mode where all the neurons are about roughly active to be destabilized. Okay, there's a linear instability, and what forms spontaneously is a bump of activity, so that you slightly perturb a neuron, it gets active, it successfully excites its immediate neighbors, and then they successfully inhibit everybody else. So that's why a bump is kind of a stable solution with strong enough weights. And so this stable bump is represented by that point in the activity space, right? Some point that's a stable point in that state space. So now there's nothing special about this bump, because actually every neuron has the same pattern of connectivity with its neighbors as every other one. So there's this invariance, rotational invariance in the system. So if the red bump is stable, then so is the blue bump. So I'm going to represent that by a blue spot there in the activity space. And in fact, all continuous shifts of this bump are also stable. And so that defines this ring of fixed points right there. Okay, so that's the high level picture of how it's possible to construct a system that has these kinds of states. Now, what is this activity state, this gray line where all neurons are roughly equally active, that's an unstable state. The system's not going to initialize in this state. It's going to go back and form some bumps, so it's going to collapse from this gray space back to this ring. Okay, so now we have this concrete example. So now to this question that I asked you earlier, which is, let's try to reach beyond analogy. Let's try to, now that these compelling ideas have been around for a while, let's try to really understand how well we can substantiate some of these models and really ask whether the brain contains. Yeah. Yeah, there are many. So in fact, let me give you a few examples of models, okay, for continuous attractor. So here are some different systems that are hypothesized to have underlying continuous attractor dynamics. One example, this is V1 orientation tuning. Okay, so this again would be modeled by a ring kind of attractor. So then there's head direction cells, which also would be modeled by a kind of ring attractor. But then there are these ocular motor neurons that have ramp-like tuning curves instead of single bumps. And these networks are also modeled as continuous attractors. And there's also, some models of place cells, also by Kitchen and others, have been modeled by sort of a 2D generalization of a ring network. So it's also bump kind of tuning curves that you get out, but instead of being in a 1D ring, it's a 2D sheet. And so, so there's a diversity. And I'll talk about grid cells, which also are some generalization of ring network to 2D and periodic. So, so there's different varieties of these models. Okay, so here are different systems that have been hypothesized to have underlying continuous attractor dynamics. And, there have been some really beautiful experimental work showing some, showing that, why these systems are good candidate systems for continuous attractor dynamics. I think the jury's really out on this one, and maybe, in fact, it's tilting away from continuous attractor dynamics in V1 and in sensory coding, but it depends on who you ask. But my belief is that I think V1 is probably not a continuous attractor system. Now, head direction cells, I think, are one of the most compelling examples to date of a continuous attractor system. They really have this beautiful tuning curves, and you can do some manipulations and show that these tuning curves sort of shift coherently relative to together with each other, even though things in the external world change. But the problem, and then oculomotor neurons, that's a circuit that has been really studied in great detail by David Tank and many colleagues of his and others who are trying to really map out even the circuit, because this is a circuit that has relatively few neurons, and they're trying to understand.
If something like you said that in V1, the jury is still out, David Forrester has some beautiful experiments in which he cools the cortex so that the cortical interactions in V1 are suppressed completely.
Yeah.
And there is still input from thalamus to V1, and he sees the orientation tuning.
Yeah.
And he concludes from that this is definitely proof that this orientation tuning is fit forward and it's not due to the recurrent network in V1.
Yeah, okay, I definitely agree with that. Okay, so I guess I should, okay, so the more careful statement is, it's not clear to what extent the lateral connectivity is playing a role in shaping those tuning curves, right? I mean, so it may not be really the continuous attractor regime, but it may be a regime where there's strong recurrent amplification, for example. And so, maybe you're not in the...
But there's not much of a memory in V1, because once the stimulus is off, it goes down. So
right.
It wouldn't be...
Right. So you don't need it.
That's right. So that's one of the arguments, in fact.
For persistence.
That's right. In fact, you would not want persistence, yeah.
So Polinsky, they were arguing that this is the origin.
That's fair enough. But it's not,
that seems not to be the case. Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Sharpening of tuning and contrast invariance.
I think it's absolutely clear that the feedforward network is to be contrast invariant.
Right, and the feedforward models don't explain that.
Now
they do. Okay, so.
But Bob Shapley doesn't.
Sure, but he's never
Bob Shapley's never gonna agree, probably, yeah. So I think I agree, right? I mean, and also there are also many philosophical reasons why, V1, even independent of any experimental results. I mean, I think philosophically, if you thought carefully about it, I think it would be unlikely that you would expect V1 to be persistent. It's not a memory system, it's a sensory system, and we really, our life is ambiguous, right?
It doesn't have to be persistant.
It's just amplification.
Connections to set the scale of the tuning.
Yeah, it's just the mode that's
scale,
not.
Is the scale of tuning what's set by the feedforward projections from thalamus and inhibitory neurons, or is it due to the recurrent connections from, I think what Forrester has established that layer 4 mm-hmm. of V1 clearly is a feedforward network, but it doesn't mean that layer 2-3. I mean, is it established that layer 2-3 may not have some recurrence to come back?
It's not a question that you don't have recurrence. The question is, can you cool V1?
He showed that in layer 4, if you cool the cortex, you still get a localized bond.
Right.
And the amplitude reduced.
Yes.
And it's not as contrast invariant.
But then he has shown that if you put noise into it, then you get a little bit more contrast invariant.
I think there's really compelling evidence that it's a largely a feedforward system, but it's clear that that the answer is not out yet. I think that's my point, is that there is the models
for complex cells
may
still
involve a recurring connectivity. So that's why I said that the jury is, in a sense it's a bit out, but I completely agree that I would lean towards, based on the data, predominantly feed forward driven, but to what extent the lateral inhibitions are influencing things. Anyway, these are the more compelling examples, but I would say that it's even in these two cases, it's been a bit hard in the ring network case to induce enough perturbation and change in the responses to really show that despite all these perturbations, the system is still lying on the same low dimensional manifold. And then in the oculomotor system, it may be the case that the dimensionality of the system is a little bit higher than was assumed in the simplest model. So instead of being like a 1D system, it might be a little higher. And so there's still a lot of work that's ongoing in these systems. So, But this diversity of systems that are hypothesized to have underlying convenience interactor dynamics in them, they, you know, these systems are involved in short-term memory. There's some of them are involved in integration. For example, the head direction and ocular motor system are involved in the integration of motion inputs or velocity inputs. In this case, head angular head motion, and in the ocular motor case, saccade commands and vestibular commands to providing an integrated estimate of position. Okay, and also, you know, these models have been hypothesized by Peter and others to underlie, good ways to read out population codes. Okay, so this brings me to grid cells, all right? So I think that grid cells may be a very interesting system in which to investigate the possibility of low-dimensional continuous attractor dynamics. So you've all now seen grid cells, but if any of you haven't, this is a recording of a single grid cell. So an animal, a little rat, is put into a square enclosure, and it runs around foraging for some food. And what you see in black is the trajectory of the animal, and every red dot is a spike emitted by a single grid cell. Okay, and these cells reside in layer 2-3 of the entorhinal cortex in mammals. Okay, and so they've been found to exist not only in rats but also in mice, which are phylogenetic, which are quite different, far away in the genetic tree, and then also in crawling bats, and there's some evidence for grid cells from fMRI data in humans, and in fact there's actually electrophysiological evidence for grid cells in humans recently from the Buffalo lab. So it seems like these grid cells are sort of a fact of mammalian life in the mammalian brain. Okay, and so
is there something that a rat cannot do if it didn't have grid cells? I mean, are they computationally essential?
Yeah, so I'll give you some thoughts on this, okay, from my work that argue that, you know, grid cells are capable of some pretty sophisticated representation and computation, but it's specifically the ability to integrate self-motion as you walk through space into ongoing estimates of location. But I think, it's actually a bit of a subtle question. So the fact is that nobody has recently done, ever since the discovery of grid cells, people have not done careful, you know, lesion studies, knocking them out and then asking what deficits there are. So we don't really know the answer to it, okay? So it's kind of, and people often say things like grid cells may be the substrates for path integration. The reasons to think that they might be, and some very compelling theoretical reasons why they might be the substrates for path integration in the brain. But again, the experimental test has just not been done. Okay, it just doesn't exist yet. No one's even done careful path integration studies and seen whether, you know, grid cells are able to maintain a location signal or not as animals path integrate. So even the behavior without lesion has not.
Like the ants don't do the path integration.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's clear that some species can do. I doubt it. Right? I doubt it. So, yeah. So in humans, there's fMRI studies by Neil Burgess's group that was one of the first studies of grid cells, the first study of grid cells in humans. So what they did is they put people in a virtual arena, okay, in the scanner. And they were in a scanner and they were doing this outbound navigation task. So there were mountains in the background, this the circle stadium. And people would go out these radial arms, okay, and different angles. And walk there, and then they would measure the bold signal in entorhinal cortex, in medial entorhinal cortex. I guess they can't slice it that way. Okay, so it's just entorhinal cortex. They would measure the bold signal in entorhinal cortex, and what they found is a modulation in the amplitude of the bold signal at multiples of 60 degrees. Okay, and so they interpret that as a signature of, you know, you pass through, if you go through, primary axis directions, then you go through more fields than if you go at a slice that's an irregular angle that's not along the axis directions. And so that was one finding. But then Beth Buffalo did electrophysiological recordings in primates, non-human primates, free-viewing a screen. So this is a bit weird, and I don't understand this very well why this happens, but as they were free-viewing a screen, the cells in entorhinal cortex were firing in a grid pattern as a function of viewing a location on the screen. So there was no actual navigation involved. There were no vestibular cues. There was nothing. But still, she found good patterns. And then one of my colleagues at UT Austin, Zoltan Nadasti, has been recording in epilepsy patients with electrodes, human epilepsy patients, and he finds, you know, evidence of, he finds grid cells in virtual navigation tasks. Yeah, that's right.
But aren't there grid cells at all phases, right?
I mean, there are, yeah. So let me tell you a little bit more about, so this is one grid cell.
The bulb one, I'm confused. Why did you pick
out a... Oh, because all the grid cells that have different phases have the same orientation. That's key. As long as the orientation is the same, that's what matters. So, yeah, that's right. That's key. If the orientations were randomized, there would be no Bull signal modulation. Okay, so now let's get to some dynamics questions. Okay, so I would say that this crazy cell, right? These cells have, I mean, it's bizarre, right? I mean, you've got these cells that have multimodal responses, very non-local and periodic responses to a local variable, which is location. It's bizarre. And so, I mean, to my mind, that brought up, you know, two sets of questions. One's about dynamics. What are the mechanisms that can give rise to such kinds of patterns of activity? And the second one is really one about coding. You know, why would the brain contain this bizarre code for something that's this local two-coordinate variable? Why? Okay, so.
Why is it bizarre?
Why isn't it bizarre? I mean, you're representing a number, right? Two numbers. Like, it's two coordinates, x comma y, right? It's just, you know, it's two numbers, and you're representing it by this gosh awful distributed pattern of activity. It's periodic, and there are, you know, this triangular lattice, and there are cells with different periods. It's just seems arcane.
I agree.
Well, so this is like the reviewer comments. Okay. This paper is not interesting. Yeah. So okay.
Well, we'll talk about
whether or not you think it's bizarre, but I think it's bizarre. At least I almost fell out of my chair when I first heard about these, or read about these, which was actually here at KITP. Okay, so let's get to the dynamics question. Okay, so it turns out, so let's just do a simple ansatz. Let's suppose that there's a neural sheet, okay, like a sheet of neurons, and let's just consider it's one neuron, and let's consider just some simple rate-based equations, okay, for neural dynamics, where that looks like this. So now suppose that this neuron interacts with its neighbors with some kind of effective center surround connectivity. It excites its immediate neighbors, inhibits everything around it. Turns out excitation is not necessary, but inhibition is. And so if the strength is high enough, large enough, you will again destabilize the uniform mode. So let's suppose that every neuron has this pattern of connectivity with its immediate neighbors, okay, on this neural sheet. So now if you look at the intersection of constraints, so this neuron here is inhibiting everything in the ring around it. The neuron in the periphery, which is not inhibited, can now become active. If it does, it inhibits everything in the ring around it. So the intersection of the constraints forms this kind of triangular activity pattern, so that the stable states of the network in the population are these patterns that are triangular, okay? If the connectivity is isotropic, okay, then that's the solution for the system.
How do you get the repeat?
Which repeat?
The fact that it repeats three unit cell distance away from.
Because it just naturally arises from this, right? So basically, if a cell here is inhibiting everything in the ring around it, and this one's inhibiting everything in the ring around it, well, this cell right here is maximally disinhibited, right? Because it's not receiving inhibition from these guys, which it would receive inhibition from. It's not receiving inhibition from these guys that it normally would. So yeah. This cell, that intersection, is maximally disinhibited, right? So you're getting, so this,
right, if
this.
You look at one cell, as you go unit distances away from it, you get repeats.
Oh, you mean you're asking about the tuning, the spatial tuning of the cells, right?
Well, how is it, you get a nice grid pattern with one cell, but you also get the pattern repeating. It fires when you're 1 foot away. 2 feet.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this is the first part of the story, right? So hold on. So this has nothing to do with spatial tuning. This is just a pattern that's formed on the sheet, the cortical sheet.
There's not grids yet.
There's no grid cells here yet, right? I mean, it's just a sheet of neurons right now. There's no space.
This is just pattern.
There's pattern formation. There's no spatial dimension yet. That, yeah.
That's Turing instability.
Yeah, linear instability. Yeah.
You would have to worry about this actually being disordered if you try to do it.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, the biggest issues here are, okay, it's going to be a developmental question of how on earth do you form a sufficiently translation invariant connectivity profile, right? And, you know, if it's just sufficiently invariant that you can get this nice patterning. That's what you mean by disorder, right? I mean, is it possible to get a nice translation invariant?
Right, if you wrote down some dynamical equations, right? So if you just started off with some vaguely random
conditions.
Well, so there's a Turing instability at that wavelength.
Yeah, it's a linear instability.
As long as this connectivity is translationally.
No, I understand, but Turing system will generate a very defective lattice.
If you put disorder.
If you put disorder in it, right? And I'm saying, so the disorder would be, take the form of some connectivity that's not perfectly translation invariant, right? And so, no, but that's a great question, because the point is that if you break translation invariance, then the system's not gonna work so well, okay? So I think that's one of the big questions that I won't actually get a chance to talk about. One of my students has worked on a developmental model, but I think he's shown how it's possible to wire up such networks. But again, I think the hard question of getting real translation invariant is just a hard one. We haven't solved it as a community. So, I mean, I think if we're gonna believe that the brain contains these continuous attractors with translation invariants, we have to figure out how it builds them. And I think that's not an easy question.
So I mean, I'll tell you, I have a point in the sense that we still don't understand the pattern selection for these.
Yeah, there could be multiple patterns, right? I mean, one thing you could do is you could get.
What you're asking is like you could have.
Yeah.
You can have long.
You can get roles. That's right. So that.
And then there's a whole story about annealing and deep breaks out.
Yeah.
You need some sort of propagating. This
that's right. Okay, so the defect. So Boris, the defect part.
You're thinking of creating an extended lattice. Could you go back to the plot of the data? This is what this data looks like. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe 9 bars. End of the story. You're not trying to create an infinite lattice that has hexagonal symmetry over a long range, and you have to worry about effects and long range order. Yeah. It's a very small system, and there are only a few bumps within that system.
Although we don't know that about the, so this is the spatial tuning, there are a few bumps, but we don't know how many bumps are in the sheet.
The system that you're trying to explain so far, not a 1,000 by 1,000.
It's true, but we've never observed the cortical sheet.
But the cortical sheet itself, we don't know the boundaries. It's hard to relate.
But anyway, the tuning, spatial tuning has very, it's only indirectly related to the pattern of bumps. It could be, this could have been an infinite lattice, and you could still just do the spatial tuning and only get 6 bumps because your environment is small, right? So I don't think that answers the question, but the fact is it is a finite lattice, okay? We know that, the finite number of neurons. It's not infinitely large. And defect issue, actually, so we've studied, Yoram and I studied some of the defect questions, and this lattice actually is going to flow, and when you flow the lattice, it heals the defects, okay? So it's spontaneously. But there can be things, like there can be strains in this system, but the strains occur if this network has periodic boundary conditions, but if there are no periodic boundary conditions, then there's also no strain, because again, there's no mechanism for strain. But and there's some very interesting issues about boundary effects and things like that. So that's something that, you know, also is part of these developmental questions. And so, you know, someone like you who's an expert in pattern formation, I think there's some very interesting questions over there that we can definitely discuss. Also, there's the question related to what you raise about, you know, why this is not the only solution of that connectivity. You can get roles. Okay, you can get stripe kind of patterns, and it turns out that under some experimental conditions, you can also get stripes. So like, there's the Hohenbock, there's like the paper by Hohenberg and Cross and Hohenberg paper and pattern formation. So they have their own order parameter way of sort of, you know, figuring out when, you know, you have different, right? They can just dial up and down a parameter, and they can say when you switch from, you know, this what is this called, convection pattern to a roles pattern. And it turns out that in the biological system, Neil Burgess's group has observed some transition of the same cells going from a triangular lattice geometry to a striped geometry. But we don't have a good order, like a parametric characterization of when that could happen in these neural network frameworks. So that's something also that can be done.
As you mentioned, and as Sarah pointed out, that you will only need local order.
Yeah.
Not the global order.
Yeah, so that's right.
You don't really care.
I don't really care about very long range. That's right. I don't care about.
No, you can imagine doing some computation with long range.
That's right.
But I don't think that's.
But in this case, yeah, long range order doesn't matter, right? I'm not doing some crystallographic, phase transition analysis, and I care about very long length scales. So it's true. Okay, so now this is now the second step. Okay, so that's pattern formation in the cortical sheet. Now, how do you get spatial tuning? So now the second answer is, suppose that you could couple that pattern, okay, the phase of the pattern in the cortical sheet, okay, with animal motion. So in the following sense, let's suppose the animal's moving rightward, and every time the animal moves rightward, it causes the pattern in that cortical sheet to flow in some direction in the cortical sheet. Okay, let's just call it rightward. Okay, pattern flow. So you just take this projected image and move it. So now you're recording, this is an electrode, you're recording from that same neuron. over different time steps, and the pattern is flowing, and so the cell is active and then inactive and then inactive and then it gets active again, right? So now you get this spatially periodic bump pattern. Okay, so I mean, yeah, for aficionados, I can tell you how to do it, but I'm not. This is old results, so you can go. The defects, yeah, it's that's right. It's in the conversion of the periodic pattern into spatial pattern where defects become important. Exactly. So okay, so you wanted to look at the equation? Yeah, so the only changes from the simple neural equation is, you know, because now we've got to couple velocity, which is a vector, has a direction, we have to couple it to the dynamics, so we're just going to assume that the weight profile depends a bit on the angle. We give each cell an angle, we give it head direction inputs that are preferred for that angle, and in addition, we shift the weights a little bit by epsilon in that corresponding direction, and that does it, that's enough. And you can get this pattern flow. Okay, so then you can, then if the animal's moving this way and the pattern moves that way, you will get then this spatially periodic response if they're not in the 2D bump pattern. Okay, so here's that's like the two-step mechanistic model for how to get the system. Now you can see this system is a two-dimensional continuous director model because there is this pattern is a fixed point of the dynamics of the network, and all translations of it in 2D are correspondingly also fixed points, and so it's a two-dimensional manifold of fixed points at the 2D attractor, and this system is intrinsically able. It's a path integrator because you feed it motion inputs, and what it gives out to you is a phase. Right, the pattern moves as there's motion and then stops when there's no motion, so it's integrated the motion into an estimate of the new location coded in terms of the phase with respect to this periodic response. Okay, so now we want to, okay, so why was I excited about this grid cell system? I mean, so it turns out that the grid cell system is, it's possible to induce some very interesting deformations of the grid cell response and then study the dimensionality of the response in the population and see whether it does still lay confined in this low-dimensional manifold, okay? So what's the simplest thing to do, right? So you have some hypothesized continuous attractor system, we'll just plot the state space, right? If the state space, the neurons are just confined to a manifold in state space, we'll just plot their activities and see if they lie on a manifold. Right, on low-dimensional manifolds. So that's what we want to do. So here's actually fake data. This is just model grid cell data, and I'm plotting R1 and R2 of two neurons. And you know, you can see that the activity of the neurons does not cover state space, but in fact, also there's a gap here. So there's some, you know, you can squint your eyes and imagine there's some low-dimensional manifold in which these responses are lying. Maybe this manifold right here. But this is the red curve is actually R1 versus R2 for a network that has no noise in it. Okay, so the neurons are just completely deterministic spiking neurons or even rate-based neurons, and have no stochasticity in their output. Okay, but now if the neural output is Poisson, and let's consider high SNR regime where the firing rates are like 200 hertz. Okay, that's what you get. You get a blue curve. Okay,
so.
Yeah, so it turns out that smoothing doesn't help you. Yeah, so you can smooth in time. So the problem is smoothing is not denoising, because smoothing, it does, you know, it smooths signal as well as noise. So
I mean, I suppose the dynamics, it depends on the speed of
it. Depends, exactly. So
if your spike rate is high enough,
if your spike rate is high enough, but it turns out, yeah. So in this case, smoothing can help you, but it turns out that also these neurons are bursty and there's other dynamics at multiple timescales. So smoothing with a single kernel or even with some, In this case, it's not, but I'm saying the real cells are. This is just toy model, just to show you what it looks like, right? So this is now a realistic SNR. This is more like, this is like 40 hertz or something. In fact, this is still a higher SNR than the system. Okay, and now you can see this gap over here is completely gone. You can't see any sign of some lower-dimensional manifold. And this is the actual data, actual grid cell data, R1 versus R2.
You can. Tries to do, right?
Yeah, I know. He does like Gaussian process factor analysis and yeah. Things like that. So we're gonna
explicitly smooth, you infer the latent state.
That's right. That's right. So there are many, many reasons why I'm really skeptical that it's gonna work. So we're trying it, but I'm quite highly confident that it won't work.
Okay.
So, but you know, one solution is just to go to a much larger number of cells. It's just a really, really hard problem because these cells have this crazy. I mean, you look at their firing patterns and you can see how incredibly variable
they
really are.
That's right. Lam has done something where you also have, you allow an observation model which has other kinds of noise.
In it. So.
You don't make any noise in the noise assumptions and you use some kind of nonlinear dimensionality like isomaps?
Oh, but see, the thing is, nonlinear dimensionality reduction methods are just saying that if you've got high dimensional data that really are effectively low dimensional, how can you see it? Because we can't visualize 10-dimensional space, so let's map it to low dimensions.
How can you see that there is a low dimensional manifold? Can you start?
Yeah, so all those methods only work in the high SNR case. None of those methods work in the low SNR case. None of them. We've tried everything. And you can read, they don't work in the low SNR. They don't work in the low signal-to-noise regime. Because the point is, how can you tell? Like, unless you can discriminate signal to from noise, the fact is that the response is truly high dimensional, right? Look at this response. It's two dimensional. No one can argue that this does not look two dimensional, right? There's nothing about this that looks one dimensional.
So, if you can simultaneously record from tens of neurons, not just
yeah.
And you do just an isomap analysis. So what we find M1 data, now I don't know how to quantify whether the primary motor cortex data is more or less noisy data.
Yeah.
We have to look at it more carefully. But we made no assumptions about the nature of the noise. If you try to do a principal component analysis, you have a very slow decay of the eigenvalues. There is no reason to believe that there is
it's low dimensional
factor. You do isomap, you get a few eigenvalues.
Yeah.
And everybody else is flat at the same
how many cells did you use?
We use 100 cells.
Yeah, so that's the point. Okay, so I completely agree. If you have something like order, sure. So
what is isomap?
Isomap is one of these. Yeah, so
we don't have one.
That's the point. So
what I'm saying is, here you don't see this because there is two dimensions.
That's right. That's right.
I'm objecting to the idea that there is no way to know that there is a lot of
not with the handful of neurons. Right. Right. Right.
Everybody else is and that's the thickness of the noise in all the other n minus
three dimensions. Yeah. No, so Sarah, I 100% agree with you. If we had 100 grid cells that were simultaneously recorded from the same network,
you have two feet.
That's right. It's a handful. So typically, the typical data set is like four simultaneous cells.
Okay, so
and
the problem, I would argue,
that's
no,
it's handful.
The low signal to noise ratio.
That's right.
The
yeah.
Simultaneously report from enough neurons.
At present. That's right. So this is just what we're given, right? This is what we have to work with. And so none of those methods. That's right.
Because you're
that. So what can we do? Yeah. So this one is just fake data. So this is fake data, which is based on these models that I showed you with.
But what was that?
That's R1, spike counts on bins.
This is spike counts on bins smooth with the Hamming window. Right, and we optimize the Hamming window. Yeah, that's right. So, but it's just a single parameter, right? It's just a width. And so, and.
I'm moving along the track. I guess I'm surprised it's so bad on this one.
Yeah, so okay, but so here's the real data though. This, you should take that more seriously, right? Because there is a speed thing, you know. So this is.
This should work.
Yeah. At high enough SNR, it should work. That's right. So. So what can we do, right? So I posed the problem to you. I said we want to test whether this low dimensional attractor dynamics. So let's go back to the key predictions, okay, of continuous attractor networks. Huh? We could do that. That would be we could be Rip Van Winkle and go to sleep for 20 years and then get some nice data. But another approach is to go back to the model of continuous attractors and try to understand what are the real signatures of continuous attractor dynamics, okay, besides the fact that the state should be localized to some neighborhood of a low-dimensional manifold. Okay, so the first prediction is this should be, you know, in these models, there should be a uniform distribution of the preferred phase or the preferred of each of across all cells in the system, right? Because all the tuning curves are just translations of one another, and they're all equivalent, so it should be a uniform distribution. And all the neurons should have identical tuning, okay, as each other, okay, up to just a phase difference, right, a difference in phase. And the key last prediction is that there are no changes, right? The point is this system, as long as the network weights and the biophysics of the neurons is unchanged, okay, the population activity patterns are the fixed points. They're the stable fixed points, and those patterns cannot change. Okay, and their translations are also the fixed points, right? So in other words, if two neurons are in a bump, okay, in the same bump or in two successive bumps or any bumps, then they will be simultaneously, they'll be coactive, okay? They'll be the same phase. And it doesn't matter what else happens to the system, as long as these things stay the same, those neurons will have to be in the same phase. Two neurons that are out of phase will have to be out of phase. They cannot come in phase. Okay, there's nothing you can do to the system short of this to change their phase. Okay, so the prediction is there should be absolute stability relative phase, regardless of any changes in the tuning of the cells.
What do you mean by changes in tuning?
Okay, so that's great. Good, glad you asked this question. So first, let me look at the first couple of predictions, and I'll show you how it's possible to induce
first
changes in tuning.
Sounds like they're consistent
with
every single model of
the world. That's not true. So uniform distribution of relative phases. I mean, to get it really uniform, you would need some other. You would need to have something that enforces this uniformity. It's just there. You know, these oscillatory interference models. Yeah, who knows what governs the distribution or what phase they have? I mean, these are single cell models. I mean, I don't know how you would have to put in something to make it uniform. Identical tuning up to phase, that's also not necessary, right? Each cell is doing its own computation, and there can be fluctuations in their, you know, in their relative tuning. They could be different. So none of these are really, I think, specific to continuous attractor networks. So the first statement is, okay, so here are two cells simultaneously recorded, similar periods, so predictively from the same network. And what we measure is we measure the parameter ratio between cells. Okay, so here are the parameters. We take the grid network. So okay, how do we deal with this problem of, you know, this not being able to tell the dimensionality of the system to being able to do it? Well, we project the responses of the system onto a low-dimensional set of parameters, okay, which characterize the response of the system. So it's basically a form of improving the signal-to-noise ratio where we know the signal, okay, so we can then trace out throughout all the noise. And we say that the signal is just basically the locations of all these peaks, and the peaks lie on some lattice, okay, any regular lattice. So we define the lattice as having, you know, two primary lattice vectors, which have lengths, and then there's an internal angle between them, and then there's this psi, which is like the overall angle of the lattice. So now it's a six-parameter model, right? So it's like four parameters for the lattice, and then the overall phase of the response. So each cell can be described by six parameters. So let's characterize each cell by six parameters, and then let's investigate how these parameters relate to each other across cells. So we look at these four parameters that describe everything except phase. If we take the ratios between pairs of cells, then we see that are simultaneously recorded from the same putative network, then these ratios are extremely close to one. Okay, this is for a large number of cell pairs.
Can you exhaustively search the parameter space to find these bits?
Oh, yeah, exactly. We do a template matching or a maximum likelihood fit of the lattice to each of the cells.
The standard deviation.
This is the standard deviations, yeah.
So, lambda 1 means you took all this initial lambda 1
of each cell and then take the ratios. But it's for pairs. Pairs that are simultaneously recorded from the same network. That's right. Okay, and then now we also compute the distribution of phases or phase differences between pairs of cells. Okay, that's what I'm going to call relative phase and the whole thing. Exactly, and this is lambda 2 from cell 1 divided by lambda 2 by cell 2. They should all be 1 if the tuning curves are identical. It's just a question of are the tuning curves identical or not, right? For cells that are in the same network.
Wait, so lambda 1 is basically grid spacing.
Yeah. It's one of the grid spacings. I mean, you know, it could be anisotropic, right? So the key is that this is pairs of cells that are recorded on the same or nearby tetrodes, so they're from the same putative network. So the criterion is we only take the ratio of a pair of cells if their period is within 10% of each other.
So they are from the same module.
The period, you mean their lambdas?
Their lambdas are within 10% of each other, and then.
But if you only take lambdas within 10% of each other, that the biggest standard deviation can be possibly the, intended.
Exactly. And this is smaller than that, right? So
how much smaller?
So this SEM is it might have been the criterion may have been like 20%. So I have to look back.
This
but
is pretty important. Like you take 20%.
I agree.
That's distributed in there.
Yeah.
You're down to 10% already. That's exactly what you get.
That's right. But that's okay, so but you look at the pairs, so lambda 1 and lambda 2, they could be slightly anisotropic, which they tend to be. There's also angle. And there's also overall angle, right? So these two parameters are not being constrained by our selection criterion. So, right, point taken, but there are these constraints too, right? So
maybe it'd be simpler instead of looking at the pairs, you just take whatever number of cells you have and you show us the distribution, lambda 1, lambda 2, beta.
Yeah, I could do that. I mean, yeah, we could have done that,
I guess.
So this is one way to
see what's the variance.
Yeah.
Lambda 1, the variance.
Yeah, this is just like a standard SEM kind of plot, but you know.
The ratios,
how does this differ from the modularity test?
Well, this is within, it has to be within.
This is within modules, right?
Let me finish my question.
Sorry.
So, in a modularity test, basically you get the whole bunch of cells that are recorded from many electrodes. We have different spacing, different things,
different orientation, and you cluster them.
Yeah.
And you find that there are clusters, which means that, you know, if within the cluster,
yeah,
you calculate lambda 1, lambda 2, theta, and psi,
yeah,
you're going to get things that are close to you.
That's right.
So, in a sense, isn't that the modularity?
Yeah, it's similar.
This is another way of saying
it. Yeah, sure, within the network. So okay, and so
basically choose 20% or 10%.
Yeah, just as a way to, yeah, I mean, we could have just done all ratio exactly and just clustered and then said, let's just look at the ones in the cluster. This is just our way of clustering, okay? So, now, okay. Yeah.
That seems like it's going to be consistent with the study way of forming cells, right? Because you're not asking about uniform interface. You're just asking, is a phase stable, really?
No, I'm not asking about stability yet. I'm going to get there. This picture is just saying, let's take pairs of cells that are simultaneously recorded right now, and let's just take a snapshot of the relationships, okay? And I'm saying if one cell has a certain set of parameters, then the other cell has, you know, another cell that's roughly similar has basically very similar parameters. And then I'm also saying, let's look at the relative phase between the pair of cells, and it's distributed everywhere in that unit cell, okay, of the lattice. So it is basically uniform looking.
Right, so,
okay, so
that one seems sort of what you'd expect for just about anyway.
No, that's not true, because in the temporal interference models, each one is really, it's independently computing, it's receiving its own independent velocity inputs, and has its own private theta oscillation inside of it, then it's not the case, right? I mean, if it's private theta oscillation is at a slightly different angle than the private theta oscillation of the other one, you'll get, but I'm just saying that at this time of this work, then the existing oscillation models would not have predicted even this, neither the first nor the second. So without adding in something like recurring connectivity and things like that, which Neil Burgess has now done something like.
Can you say anything about what you'd expect in terms of the correlations for cells that are further apart?
Yeah, okay, let's get to that too. Okay, so we'll, you mean in different networks, the different periods? The short answer is that cells that have very distinct spatial periods, which, you know, the language is now that these are discrete modules or discrete networks, cells in different networks don't really seem to be very correlated in any sense. I mean, there's some evidence that maybe their orientations are a little bit more aligned than you would expect them to be by chance, but that may be a developmental thing,
going,
right? So
going to a different tetrahedron in the same experiment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. If it's a different period, you don't expect, right? If you have two sine waves that are different frequencies, then you don't if their phase is in phase here, they're not going to be in phase here, right? So you don't expect any relationship.
If you have 223 cell
pairs, yeah,
if you raise into the different modules that they come from,
mm-hmm,
do you see any difference, any systematic difference?
That's a good question. We haven't looked at it by, so your question, I guess, just to interpret it a bit more, you're saying, is there any variation with period in the similarity of cells? That's a good question. We haven't actually looked at that. You know, most of the recordings tend to be more dorsal in all of these cells, and so it's not like we've got, you know, a huge collection of periods, distinct periods, but there are probably a few periods that one could look at and answer that question. So, okay, so now let's get the more interesting, right? So Peter's not satisfied, so let's try to satisfy Peter. Okay, so that was just a simple fact of, you know, this is instantaneous responses and nothing about stability or anything like that yet.
So delta?
Yeah. So that's great. So this is just the relative phase. So each cell has a 2D phase, right? It's a periodic response, so there's a 2D phase. And it's a difference in phase between cell 1 and cell 2. So that's delta alpha beta is cell alpha, cell beta, and it's a difference. And then there are two coordinates of the phase variable, right? Delta 1 and delta 2.
You're arguing that's uniform.
That's uniform. I'm arguing that, you know, yeah, this is a sample from a uniform distribution, right? It looks like. It's consistent with
so
a sample.
So two cells, although they have the same period, they have the same lattice characteristics, they are arbitrarily phased.
That's right, exactly. Their phases are distributed, you know, through the whole lattice, right? They take the whole distribution of phases. Okay, so now what's the next finding? Okay, so now what the experiment involved was the following. So these cells were recorded. The first experiment I showed you, these cells are recorded in an environment, and then the animal is taken out of that environment for 1 to 3 hours. It does its own thing. It maybe goes to different environments. It goes to home and rests or whatever. Then the animal is put back into that same environment, first environment, and then the cells are recorded again. Okay? And the question is, what has anything changed? Okay, and what about the relative phases? Have they stayed the same or not? Okay, so here's the finding. This is the change in time of the relative phase. Okay, by time I mean these two exposures in that environment. Okay, so this is a plot of the change in time of the two different change in the relative phase of cell pairs across these sessions. Okay, and this is the set of changes that we find. Okay, and the red circle is an error measure. Okay, so this red circle comes from, so you construct a Rayleigh distribution from the distribution of basic phase estimation error. Given the neural responses, the sum uncertainty in estimating phase, so you take that, you construct a Rayleigh distribution about magnitudes of relative phases, and you can see that these x's basically are consistent with this error bar in the sense that the distribution of relative phase differences just sits right on top of the Rayleigh distribution. So there's no difference. So there is no significant difference in the relative phase between pairs of cells.
The cells are in the same place every time.
Huh?
Place cells are in the same place.
Ah, okay, good, great. So this is the second part. So that's the, so right, so you might say the place cells, or...
The grid cells are in the same place.
Exactly. So it might be that, the grid cells are anchored by the world, right? You're putting them in a familiar environment, they've got all these cues, they know exactly what absolute phase to start at, and they do, and so there's no difference. So how can you tell the difference between external stabilizing cues versus internal stability? Okay, and here's the answer to that. So this is an analysis of the change in the phase of the single cell itself. How much do the phases of single cells, right? This was the change in the relative phase. I'm asking, what is the change in the phases of the cells across those two sessions? Okay, and the finding is that this is the distribution of the change in phases across the two of single cells across the sessions. And here is now the error circle. So this is the Rayleigh distribution that you would expect from just uncertainty in estimation phase. And this is the actual distribution of changes in the single cells phases. Okay, so it means that the changes in the phases of the single cells exceed the changes in the relative phases, which means that you cannot attribute the stability of the relative phase to any external stabilizing cues that are stabilizing the phases themselves. Okay, it's really a relative phase or a network phenomenon. Yeah.
Can you quantify the lines? What is the
scale?
No,
the
what is the scale?
Oh, this is the unit cell of the lattice, and the phase goes from 0 to 1, right? Where 1 is equal to 0. So this is the unit cell, right? This is the possible distribution of phases can be in that. That's the unit. It's just the diamond of the lattice. Okay, so that's one statement. Okay, so now here's an interesting experiment I skipped a couple of experiments that were done that involve squeezing familiar environments and the response gets distorted. And it's too much to describe, but here's one that I wanted to also describe because it eliminates another possibility. This is experiments where the animal is taken from a familiar environment and now it's placed into an environment that it's never been in before. It's called a novel environment. Okay, so it's never been there. And the general finding is, let's just concentrate, there's a lot of data here. This is just the response of one cell. Cell one, okay, when you put it in a familiar environment and take it out and put it in the novel environment, then its response changes. How does it change? Well, this parameter lambda one and lambda two, this is the ratio of the parameter lambda one in the new environment compared to its parameter in the familiar environment for that one cell. Okay, the fact that it's bigger than one means that that period has expanded. Okay, and the same thing has happened with lambda 2. It's expanded a little bit. It's anisotropic. As you can see, the expansion is not as big for lambda 2, and so on. And the x-axis is just telling, it's showing you the different trials within the day. Okay, so it goes novel, 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 and then back to the familiar. And then the next day, it's again, some cells are recorded. And again, it's novel, 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 and familiar, and so on. And then you can see that there's a relaxation over time, so that only after the fifth day or something are the ratios back to the ratios that they were, to the values that they were in the familiar environment. So grid cells really distort their responses in novel environments, and they take a very long time scale to relax back to the values that they have in familiar environments. Okay, this is another cell, cell two, that does the same kind of thing. There's an expansion, and so on.
This is presentations in the same novel environment?
That's right. This is the same novel environment, and it's just habituating to it.
And the two cells fade back to the same relative phase?
Over the course of days. They fade back to the values that they had in familiar environments. So on the y-axis, it's the ratio of the parameter of the cell in the novel environment divided by the familiar environment. Each of the colors, so that's lambda 1 ratio, lambda 2 ratio, theta ratio, and psi ratio.
And why is it always in the positive or
We had to pick a choice, right? I mean, you can flip the ratio. It's just a ratio. We just made it so that all the ratios are above one. You see? Lambda one,
it's not like the novels are bigger than
that. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not true because there are negative values. No, so we thought about that. Okay, okay, so it's the case that whenever the animal goes in a novel environment, the grid expands. That's a phenomenon. So that's why they're all positive. Yeah, that's right.
Or resolution.
The grid, maybe. But in 2D, not by the tuning curve argument, right? So the question is, are the blobs more diffuse? So the blobs were more diffuse, it would be more noisy. So the third part is.
Is that predicted in your model?
What, the blobs expanding? No, let's discuss that offline. It's too much, too involved. But we'll discuss it. But just not. One of them expands a lot. The other one expands, but not as much. It's anisotropic in this case, right? And so expansion in general is generic, but you know how much anisotropy you get is not generic. That varies. So now what we do is we just take the ratio, okay? We take, this cell has changed its tuning. This cell has changed its tuning, but have they changed their tuning exactly in concert with each other or not? That's the question, right? And so we take these ratios of these cells. Then we find actually the ratios are not statistically significantly different than one. They're basically one, okay, up to estimation uncertainty. Okay, from the very first trial one in the novel environment, they're identical. Nothing has changed about them, despite this gross distortion in the single cell response. Okay, and now I should mention that at the same time that grid cells are doing this, place cells are remapping. They're doing total remapping, okay? Not just rate remapping, they're doing total remapping. So they cannot be responsible for the stability of these ratios. So previously I established that it can't be external cues. Now we're arguing that it cannot be hippocampus. Okay, it must be internal within. Perhaps, yeah, it's something within the entorhinal cortex. They don't remap, so it could be them, right? But all I'm saying is it's not hippocampus, it's not external cues, it's some network, and. I guess there are. They're boundary. So there's border cells in entorhinal cortex, and there's boundary vector cells in hippocampus. Huh? That's where Neil Burgess first proposed them, right? It was hippocampal data.
So anything that is close to border.
Oh, okay, yeah, but that's part of hippocampus, right? I mean,
it's not
system.
CA1,
not C1, CA3, that's right, yeah. But it's part of the hippocampal system, I guess, yeah, so. About what? About where they are, you mean, or whether you believe?
Yeah,
but they project to S-RAP.
Yeah, subiculum does project to EC. That's the fact.
But in entorhinal cortex itself, you have the border cells, which are.
Yes. Yeah, border cells, which are not the same as boundary vector cells, but similar. So that's why I wanted to show you this experiment. You cannot attribute the stability to place cells.
In all these results that you showed, did you study any difference where which layer the cells came from?
All these cells are layer 2, basically. I mean, well, they're not. I mean, we don't know from like the. We don't have tracked studies, like you know, tracing of the electrode paths. But we infer that they're layer 2 because they have almost zero. They have zero directional tuning, very very minuscule. I mean, none basically. So based on the direction tuning, it's
All medial entorhinal.
All these are all medial entorhinal and putatively layer 2 from what we can tell. Yeah. I wish we had some direction tuned cells, actually, for various reasons. Yeah.
Have you tried to come up with explanations for this result that would not involve an attractor?
Not us. I mean, we haven't tried because. I can't imagine anything that would. I mean, the fact is, no. Look. It's just a simple fact. It's just empirical observation that the responses are lying on this low dimensional manifold, right? So everything's varying, but the relative phase is not, right? That defines the 2D manifold because it's a 2D relative phase, and they're all over the place and they're conserved. So that's that. I mean, it's just a fact. Now, what models can give rise to the attractor dynamics? There are actually many models that can give rise to 2D attractor dynamics, but I think. Peter and then Dean? This is the definition of an attractor. If the system is confined, if you have a dynamical system that's confined to a low dimensional manifold, there is an attractor. That's it.
Well, I would fundamentally disagree with that. So you know, there's very, very strong evidence that cells are coupled.
Yeah.
So technically, a tractor has to exist with that input. I mean, you can argue if that's a, like a super important definition. But
yeah.
So clearly, these grid cells know about the outside world because they're aligned in the right place. So they get some input from the outside world.
That's right.
But I think so. The big question is, so what's the relative contribution of input from the outside world to the lateral connectivity, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to put numbers on it given this.
Ketchum might know the answer better, but I'd still be confused with your answer about the Russell-Chang interference models saying that they don't account for this in the sense that they're not really independent modules, because I think that's what Peter Debbie term. They're correlated with each other because they do share common velocity inputs, common inputs.
Well, okay, so I would not characterize Kitchen's model with the Welday paper. I would not characterize that as an oscillatory interference model. That's fundamentally an attractor network model. I mean, it's ring networks. It's underlying. It's ring networks.
So
it's,
that model would generate this.
So the original oscillatory interference.
Yeah,
the cells weren't coupled.
That's right.
But I think the coupling is really, you need to add the
actuator. That's right. I think Kitchen's model is fundamentally an attractor network. It's ring networks. That's what it is. I mean, you know, so and the activity goes around the ring.
Attractors out of oscillators, and then this thing is data.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the oscillatoriness of it.
That accounts for all this. It's the attractorness of it. Exactly.
But it's not attractive. You're just arguing for the cells to talk to each other.
Well, no, I'm arguing something much stronger. I'm saying that the system is on a two-dimensional manifold, and it's not on a bigger manifold. Well, I'm saying that. No, what do you mean? If you have a stochastic system that's n-dimensional, that has n components in it that are stochastic, and then the degrees of freedom are actually effectively frozen out, so it's only localized on a two-sheet.
But you're measuring.
It implies attractor dynamics, right?
Hold on a second. Attractor dynamics, at least the original definition, was you take away all input and it's still there. So it may be too strong a definition.
That's too strong. That's not a right definition. That's an incorrect.
That's
that is too strong. Because in fact, this model is all.
The system can be defined in terms of an attractor
with input
as part of the system.
That's right.
So in that case, how exactly are they defined?
So in this case, the input is a uniform input, and the interactions, lateral interactions, are inhibitory. Okay, so if you take away the uniform excitation, then the activity just collapses to zero.
The attractor is just the omega limit set of the dynamical system.
Exactly.
So in principle, you can have an attractor that has no low-dimensional manifold.
That's right.
But you can also have an invariant manifold of a lower dimension, such that it's a stable invariant manifold that could also be an attractor.
That's right.
You could have a fixed point as an attractor.
That's right. So I mean it in. Yeah, so it's in Carson's sense of this low dimensional invariant manifold, right, that the system is localized to. That's my definition of an attractor. And I think that's a standard definition. It's not this neural definition of a self sustained activity bomb.
So what else? If you put the rat in a 3D environment, you put stairs in.
Yeah, people have done, so Kate Jeffries' group has done recordings in 3D environments. You could argue that maybe her 3D environments are just facsimiles of real 3D environments, they're not sufficiently rich in 3D, but okay, given that caveat, the kinds of 3D environments that she studies, what she finds is in the third dimension, the Z direction dimension, it's just, it's cylinders, okay? So basically it's a projection. Exactly. So, but you could argue about whether she's...
The right experiment is what
Yeah, that's right. The bats. That's right.
Yes, one more question. His talk, he showed one last slide was this kind of globby. It's very difficult to say whether it had any kind of symmetry, but there was some sort of globbiness in the.
So there could be a 3D map.
It could be a 3D map. But no one knows.
That's right. So that's the real question, because even rodents, they don't really live in 3D. They climb structures, but it's 2+ dimensions. It's not really 3 dimensions. So I think that's right. You could do,
You can find them in the 1D without this. You put tubes or something.
Oh, yeah, okay. I can show you some 1D stuff. Actually, I'm going to do that next. Yeah.
So basically what you've shown is they live in a 2D attractor.
That's
2D
right. They're localized to 2D manifold.
So you call it attractor. Is it 3D when you call it attractor?
It would be a 3D attractor manifold. Yeah, that's right. It's ND.
Everything is
ND. Yeah.
But it's the alerts.
The omega limits.
But every dynamical system has a limit, right?
Yes. It could go to infinities.
Yeah. I think on Friday we have a session to discuss it.
On attractors. So let's.
No, you're not going to be enough.
Very good. Thank you, Kitchen. Thank you for saving me. Okay. So. Okay, so let me just make one more point about continuity of the manifold. Okay, so right now I've tried to show you about that there's stability of the relative phase. Okay, relative phases are stable. So there are these, the manifold is defined by these cells that have identical tuning curves, and they only differ by their 2D relative phases. And the relative phases are stable. Okay, so that's your manifold. That defines a manifold. But one thing I didn't show you is, is it really kind of discrete or is it really continuous? And can we start to answer that question with the small amount of data that we've got? And I'd say, I want to just present the following evidence to say that it's not. So what's an example of a discrete system that would be similar to, that would have similar findings from all the things that I've shown you, but would not be continuous? Well, an example of a discrete system would be you just take a bunch of grid cells that have the same orientation and period, right, which is, which we've taken, and in addition, they have the same phase, okay, the same, the relative phase is zero, okay, so they're in phase with each other, and you group them into one little recurrent network, and then you take another group of cells that have a different, but the same relative phase as each other, and you group them, so instead of having one continuous attractor network of 2D with a continuum of relative phases, you've just got these discrete sets of networks, each of which has a homogeneous relative phase within it, but they have the diversity of relative phases. So in that case, you might expect, okay, so let's consider those two possibilities, and then let's look at the data. So it turns out that the similarity of grid parameter ratios, so how similar pairs of cells are, okay, their degree of similarity as a function of their relative phase, this is data. Okay, this is data on the similarity of grid cell parameters across trials, meaning the stability of the parameters, okay? The stability of the parameters, it's staying close to the values previously measured. Okay, the stability as a function of relative phase is given here. And this is the stability of the relative phase. So this is the four parameters, and this is the two remaining parameters, which is relative phase. So this is the stability in relative phase. This is the stability of all the other parameters in the ratios. And you can see that actually there is no clumpiness in this data, and there's no sense in which cells that have more different relative phases are less similar to each other or less stable with respect to each other as cells that have very similar relative phase, which is what you would expect. Sorry?
Why is it uniformly distributed
to 0 to 1? Why is this? The relative phase, because relative phase goes from 0 to.
Divided by 2 pi.
No, there's no 2 pi here. So everything.
You divide by 2 pi.
Yeah, 0, 1. Yeah, phase goes from 0 to 1 in our definition.
Yeah, there's a gap below 0.1 and above 0.55.
That certainly is not.
That's the non-uniformity of the.
But that was very different from that issue earlier, which is really uniform all the way across.
All the happy people were the same thing.
These are relative. I think Peter's asking why the cells initially were uniform in that diamond right here. Okay, they go all the way out to here. Yeah, it might be between 0. That's right, because these are relative phase, right? So this is relative phase magnitudes. This is relative phase magnitudes, that's why.
Then that should go between 0 and 0.5.
Yeah, it should go between 0 and
0.5. So, wait, what?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, no. Well, because it's a two-dimensional variable, right? So each component of relative phase goes between 0 and 0.5, and you have to take the vector sum of those. That's why it is. Exactly. Correct. That's right. Okay, so that.
You have no way to get above 0.7.
That's right.
Except how to get 0.8.
It's probably 0.7, but it's correct, right? It's from the it's absolute magnitude of the relative phase relative phases, and then it's two dimensional, so we should be able to
1/2.
Yeah, 1/2.
So
I don't remember.
Let me see, red versus blue. It might be two. Oh, one of them is from this novelty experiments. One of them is stretching experiments. So it's across these different experiments that we do.
So you have a bath in that.
Okay, so I hardly have any time for coding. So, all right. So the statement here is that the these properties of the system, right? The similarity of parameters across cells, the stability of the parameters, and the stability of the relative phase is not a function of the relative phase. Okay, which suggests that there's no clumping of cells in the recurrence with only their similar phase partners. Okay, so it really is kind of continuous. Okay, so there was a dynamic story which I'm not going to get into to show that relaxations of the perturbations from the manifold go back to the manifold. Okay, and I'm also not going to tell you about 1D environments, although the statement is, I'm going to make the statement about 1D dynamics, so, and anyone interested, I can talk to you about it later. So the statement about 1D dynamics is the following. So when animals are measured in 1D systems, so this is a recording from virtual environment in David Tang's lab, and the animals run down these 1D virtual tracks, and then we look at the responses of grid cells as a function of location on the track, then you can see, so these same cells are recorded in 2D, where it's verified that they're grid cells, like in real 2D environments, and then you record them in these virtual 1D tracks, and you can see that the responses of these different cells, these are five cells simultaneously recorded, these are cells that belong to the same network according to their 2D responses, they have the same orientation, same angle, and and period, and everything. But their 1D responses look very different, right? They're definitely multimodal, but they don't look as regularly spaced. There's variation in the heights, and these different cells don't just look like simple translations or phase shifts of one another. Okay, so the question here is, you know, is the system in a different dynamical regime when the animal is traversing 1D paths, or is it really just a 1D traversal through the same 2D dynamics, okay? And so the bottom line, I'm not going to tell you all the story, but there's some very beautiful analytics that were done by Sam Llewellyn in David Tang's group in Princeton, and Ki Jung Yoon in my group, and some data analysis that shows quite compellingly that actually these 1D responses are slices through the 2D lattice, and in fact, we can use these 1D responses and predict the relative phases of pairs of cells, okay, both analytically and numerically, and they match up beautifully with the measured 2D responses in 2D environments. Okay, so...
Wait, if you put in 1D track, measure these things, predict what happens, and then they make the track bigger, you get the cell.
No, so the statement is like, if we look at these 1D responses, and we compute what slice through a 2D lattice gives you this response. We do the same thing for this cell and this cell. So we get the...
Right?
Yeah.
And you can know what the environment see if that's consistent.
Sorry, what was that? Oh, expand the environment.
You let them run and run side by side.
Yeah, you can do that. But the thing is, like, there's all this remapping and stuff that happens. So, you know, there's complicated things that happen when you change environments. So, but we can predict the slice angles and things like that. So, I want to skip. Just motion blur here is going to happen because I want to get to some coding part. Okay, so I guess I just wanted to summarize the dynamics part. So so the question is, you know, with some further substantiation of the continuous subtractor hypothesis based on data and analysis, you know, can we say that we've moved beyond analogy and thinking about these continuous subtractor models of how the brain does memory and integration? Okay, the second point is that, you know, it certainly lends some support on an abstract level for grid cell models based on continuous subtractor dynamics, and also suggests that maybe these cells maybe are capable of integration and memory. Okay, and it poses a constraint on alternative models that are starting to be satisfied by adding recurring connections and things like that. And even in 1D systems, the 1D trajectories, the system seems to appear in the same dynamical regime, which is important because animals often navigate. They'll navigate in open spaces and then run along walls and things like that. So if you're really interested in the question of navigation, it's important to know whether the 1D response and codes are in the same, are generated by the same computations as the 2D responses. Okay? So that was that for the first half.
First half.
11 minutes, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, so let me see. All right, let me see. Okay, so let me go through this quickly. All right, so I want to talk about how grid cells are coding information, okay, about location. And I want to contrast their strategy for coding information about location with the kinds of codes that we're very, very familiar with, that we often talk about and are analyzed at great length in the theoretical literature, and understand whether the properties are similar or different, okay, than the codes that we are familiar with in the theoretical literature. So here's this very familiar example of the single bump kind of codes. These are different neurons with different tuning curves that are just shifted versions of one another. And you know, in a common view of how neurons deal with noise and representing a variable is that many neurons participate in coding of that single variable. And so in this case, if a stimulus is presented over here, all of these cells whose tuning curves overlap that value will fire spikes with some variable number. And so now if you try to reconstruct, you take the angle, stimulus angle theta, construct the spikes R, and then from it try to estimate theta hat. The question is, estimate, what is the error in your estimate of the represented variable? Okay, and so the calculation, standard calculation, so all and everything I'm going to tell you, I'm going to assume that neurons conditioned on their tuning curve are independent. They fire Poisson spikes, and you know, all you care about is the rates, right? The counts coming out of the neurons. So we can debate those assumptions, but in that framework, this is what these kinds of population codes can do. So the mean squared error, the Fisher information in these codes goes up like n, and the mean squared error goes down like 1 over n, okay? So it's like 1 over Fisher information in these codes, okay? So this is work by Kitchen and various other people. This was in the 90s that it was done. Okay, so I'm going to call all codes that exhibit, okay, so we can talk about accuracy as the inverse mean squared error, okay? So any code that exhibits a polynomial, or in this case specifically linear, okay, gain in accuracy with n, I'm going to call that a classical population code, okay? So any linear increase in accuracy with n or polynomial increase n to some power, it's called, I'm going to call it a classical population code. Okay, so let's go to a back to that geometric view of kind of you know, looking at codes in this as embeddings in state space. So in a geometric view, you know, so that was like a algebraic view. Okay, so we computed this thing by algebra, right? Computed Fisher information, compute mean squared error, and this is what you get. It doesn't give you real insight. Okay, so I want to show you that you can get the same understanding for scaling with n by looking at this picture geometrically. So you have some variable like theta. It's okay. It's something like this. It goes from 0 to 1 or and now you've got the state space, okay? And this is a state space of n neurons, okay? And in this curve, the single bump code, you've got the coding line, okay? The code, all of those point the state space as it changes as you vary the variable value, okay? If you ignore the Poisson spiking for now, but just look at the tuning curve responses, it will lie on this circle, okay? It just lies on this one-dimensional ring, this manifold. And what is the length of this? Okay, so and then there's a noise ball, okay? So the neurons are having these Poisson spikes, and actually the ball isn't really a nice ball, but you know, it's like a ball. And so this is the noise ball, so this is the variability of single neurons, and this is a single neuron property, okay? So the radius of the ball doesn't change as you increase the number of neurons. Now, what is changing when you increase the number of neurons? Well, consider this ring. Okay, this ring is basically an embedding along the diagonal of this n-dimensional space. And we know that the diagonal of an n-dimensional cube goes up like root n, right, in length. So that means the circumference of this line, the length of this coding line, is going up like square root of n. Okay?
Circle, right? I mean, or what's the sort of shape of this?
Yeah, that's details. I'm only looking at scaling with n. Okay, the shape, the detailed shape and stuff will
which
factors.
Space, not a space filling curve, I guess.
Yeah, this is not right. And no, this is specifically just this is specifically these bump codes, right? That's not going to be a space. This is the manifold is just a ring. It's just a circle. So and the shape of the circle, you know, it changes a bit depending on the tuning curve width and stuff. And those are all pre-factors. They don't really influence n. Although, yeah, actually that's not quite true. But anyway, it doesn't change n from being something that's not polynomial. It's still going to be polynomial. Okay, so.
Sure, but so would a space-filling curve. It was a topologically put into a
circle. Yeah, we'll get to space-filling curves. So.
Statement about it's not a circle, right? It's
yeah.
She just said the diagonal of the hypercube.
Won't be the diagonal unless all neurons are active at once, right?
Yeah, but it's roughly diagonal. Come on. Okay, so this is really a circle. Okay, so it is a circle. It's a closed circle for bump curve. Yeah, it's a circle. It is a circle. For identical bumps, it's a circle. For bumps that you just shift around, it's a circle.
It's not a correct geometry.
It's not a circle.
It is a circle.
No way.
For identical bumps that rotate. No. Okay. Fine. I mean, so Jonathan, so it depends. So it depends on the width of the tuning curve.
So
I agree. It depends on the widths of the bumps,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And but I'm telling you that the scaling is roughly like this. Okay, the width of the bumps, the scaling with n is not going to be different than polynomial in n.
That
okay,
is,
and yeah, so okay, so okay, so all right, let's just take that for now because I'm limited in time and let's discuss some more. Okay, so the point is that the noise ball radius does not scale with n. This scales somehow polynomially with n. Okay, and so the what is the range over the resolution? okay, is really the dynamic range of the code, right? That's what matters, okay? That is what the code is capable of representing in the presence of noise. And so that's a quantity, or the error will go like, so if this is a unit ball, then the error will go down as the coding line increases, okay? So basically you can see the fractional error will then go this one over root n, and so the accuracy goes like n. Okay, so that's the intuition behind it. So then, you know, these standard codes are all have this polynomial scaling with them. Okay, these codes that you've all seen. Okay, so now I'm going to skip some of this stuff, and I just want to make the claim, okay, and I want to then just show you. The claim is that the grid cell code is, in theory, capable of exponentially strong scaling with n in the same metric, okay, in terms of the range or the resolution that it can encode. Okay, and so that's the statement. So it's a qualitatively different code, right? So the classical population codes that we're accustomed to seeing, that we've looked at, that are very familiar with from the sensory motor peripheries, they have polynomial, in fact, usually no better than n squared scaling. In fact, I've yet to see any case where the scaling can be bigger than n squared if you ignore correlations. Okay? What? Usually you get n. So, okay, we'll talk to you about that later. So David Schwab and I just are finishing some work where we're seeing that the optimal scaling you can achieve is n squared over log n. So that's the mean squared error optimum. Okay, so that's the claim, and let me just show you then the result. Okay, so the result.
CPC stands for what?
Classical population code. That's like the codes that have this polynomial scaling. So So let me just go here. Okay, so I don't want to go through all this. Okay, so let me just briefly then tell you the formalization of the grid cell code, and then tell you the statement and show you why it's true, and then that'll be the end of this talk. Okay, so let's just consider one dimension, one spatial dimension, and let's consider the group of neurons that have a common period and orientation. Okay, so in one spatial dimension, whether this cell is firing, if the blue cell is firing, you just know where you are as a phase within this periodic response of the whole network. Okay, so in other words, the firing of all the neurons in one network are only telling you this phase. It's like you take the variable x, the location of the animal, divide by the period, and then take mod 1. And that's a phase variable that tells you everything that this network is going to tell you about this location x. Okay, so really there's not just one period, right? So there's a diversity of periods along the dorsoventral axis that are actually not very different in size. They're within one decade of size. They're not really a big span of periods, all right? But even though the animal cares about locations that actually have a much bigger span of distances than the span of these periods. Okay, so what the code is, okay, in all the grid cells across all periods, it's a set of phases, okay? They're n phases, they're n different periods, they're n phases, each one just a modulo with respect to its period. Okay, so that's the formalization of the grid cell code. Okay, so I always say that this is like, you know, clocks, you know, instead of one 12-hour clock, you've got, you know, a 12-minute clock, a 13-minute clock, and a 14-minute clock, and so on, representing time. You walk into a room, and what's the use of that? Okay, so so here's the picture of what this code looks like. Okay, so the code is this n-dimensional phase vector, and so we can view it as this n-dimensional phase vector as a point on this n-dimensional torus, right? Because it's a circular variables. So as you increase x from 0, then this line just goes around, and it goes around and around and around. In fact, if you let it keep going, it's a space-filling curve. And but if you truncate at some, you know, if you just stop at some x, okay, so for any finite width of the line, you know, you keep going until the space is filled, okay? But if you truncate well before that point, okay, so let's call that big point R. So if you truncate before that R, like say here, in x, then you end up with these beautifully interleaved lines with a lot of gray space or unused coding space right in between them. So the interstices, they're nicely separated, it turns out, for pretty generic choices of lambda. So it's a very kind of nice code. So and the point is that the length of this coding line scales like some scale factor lambda, the typical period. Okay, and then n is in the exponent. Okay, so now you can get these coding lines that are exponentially long. Okay, even though nothing else is exponentially big, the lambdas are all just, you know, size, you know, just a finite size. So statement is that if you encode and decode information over exponentially large ranges, okay, so let's consider ranges R that are much smaller than this big R, this e to the beta n with lambda in the front, but you put a prefactor. Let's put a prefactor in the exponent rho. And rho is something that goes between 0 and 1. So that's something called an information rate. You're not going to use the full coding line capacity. You're not going to let the pasta noodle fill all space. You're going to stop it at some point. Okay, so you put in that row. So now, but it's still exponentially large. Okay, so now if that's true, if you encode and decode over that range, and you compare, so you look at the performance of these N networks, these N grid cell networks, okay, doing this encoding and decoding over the range, and they're M neurons per network, M per network, and then N networks, and you compare it with the classical population code, okay, that has N times M neurons, yeah, that are like place cells. Yeah.
Okay. We're not going to quite stop you.
Okay.
We're going to take a brief 2-minute break for those of us who want to go get coffee and got some water, and maybe I'll come back and...
Continue.
Who wants to come back and...
5 minutes.
Wait, 5 minutes? What do you want, 5 minutes?
I would rather go for 5 minutes than have a break.
That's true. Let's just...
I'm not going to go for 5 minutes.
I promise I'll finish in 5 minutes. I promise I'll finish in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Should we just do that?
Yes.
Because it's 10:30 and I'll just finish at 10.
No, we'll lose the narrative attention.
Okay.
5 minutes. That's right. Stay tense. Okay, so here then is a picture, okay? So you encode and decode with N networks, M neurons per network, okay? With the grid cell code, black line, and then you do the same thing with like a place cell-like code, which is just bumps, single bump code, okay? Over the same space, okay? Over the same 0 up to RL, okay? And with NM neurons in that one network, okay? So same number of neurons, same Poisson noise per neuron, and same coding range. Okay, so we look at the posterior distribution of guesses. This is what you get, okay? You get a peek at the true position. But let's just zoom in, and if you zoom in, you'll see that the posterior distribution from the grid code is much, much narrower than the posterior distribution that you get from the classical population code. And so if I quantify it, the question is how narrow is that posterior distribution of guesses compared to that one for the same number of neural resources and everything that you've put in. So the ratio of the widths of the posteriors is actually, it's exponentially narrow in N. Okay, and that's something we compute analytically, and if you're not satisfied with the analytical computation, then we can show numerically too, by actually sampling from the posterior, that if we plot the log of that ratio as a function of N, it goes down linearly, which means that it is going down exponentially in N. Okay, so numerically and analytically we can show that the grid code allows exponential gains in this accuracy compared to classical population code. Okay, so it enables us exponentially better estimation than those codes. Okay, and now I want to end with an intuition figure to try to show you, like we talked about this geometric view of the classical population codes. So here's the geometric view of the grid cell code. Why is it that this works so well? Okay, so the reason it works so well is that it preserves the grid cell code, because each single network is like an attractor network. It preserves the fact that the coding is on a low-dimensional manifold. It's a one-dimensional line. But the difference is that there's a whole lot more line packed into that n-dimensional space, okay? So now your coding line, okay, your ball radius, again, for single neurons, it's not doesn't depend on the code or anything. It's just a single neuron property. But now your coding line length is scaling exponentially in N, okay? And when you take the ratio here, your fractional error induced by that kind of noise ball, it goes down exponentially with N. Okay, so that's the story. So the point is that classical population codes take advantage of low-dimensional manifolds by embedding the code, a low-dimensional line into a high-dimensional space. But they're very wasteful. They put a very small amount of coding line into the space, and this one actually just uses the space a lot more efficiently while maintaining the benefits of the low-dimensional coding line. Okay, so the point, the summary statements are just that the grid cell code for location is potentially the first example of an analog exponentially strong population code in the brain, and this exponential scaling is actually a signature of strong error-correcting analog codes in the Shannon sense. And the question is, should this be a new benchmark for efficiency in discussions on neural redundancy? Okay, and so I'll just put up the last slide, and then I'm done. So would that be 5 minutes? It's less than 5 minutes. Oh, since I've got 2 more minutes, I want to just... I'm going to show... This is my last slide. My last slide, I promise. This is the last slide. Okay, so this is for Peter, because... I want to talk to you about, the idea of what is it that hippocampus is doing in the systems. I've talked about grid cell code and dynamics. And I just want to make the point for all of you, especially the theorists and also the experimentalists, that, navigation is a pretty hard problem, okay? It involves sequential probabilistic inference, okay? And why may probabilistic inference be critical in the problem of navigation? Okay, so here's something.
Can we really leave this for Friday? Because
okay.
Any statement, navigation is a hard problem, for me, is the beginning of
It's the beginning, problem. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so let me leave that and I'll just give you my acknowledgement.
I look at the map and I go from here to there.
Okay, fine.
I'd like to understand what you mean by navigation.
Okay, fine. So this is just a credit slide. These are my students who've done a lot of the work. My collaborators, Yoram and Neil Burgess and Caswell Berry, have done, and Sam Lawallen have done a lot of the, and David Tank have done a lot of the work that was that I talked about today. So thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Peter, you owe me a dollar.
So Ela, there's still a cost
yes.
in the sense that
so easy.
You can embed more.
No.
Because now you're still bound by the fact that you have another path that's nearby.
Yes, that's right.
It's all over the box side. Here's two boxes.
Okay, exactly, great.
You only pack one long string.
That's right. So it turns out, so you're exactly right. So there are two kinds of errors that are that exist in coding, right? So there's the local errors that we compute with Fisher information and things like that. Okay, and so that's what contributes to sort of this improvement with multiple neurons. And classical population codes, because they're so sparsely packed, the coding line is so sparsely packed, you never have this problem where the noise ball can put you in a different part of the segment altogether, right? And by packing in more coding line, you incur the risk of the noise ball. If the next segment is too close, the noise can then put you on an adjacent segment of the coding line. And those are called threshold errors. In fact, the size of that error is about as big as the range itself. Okay, so that's right. So what you want to do is the probability of that error depends on how much coding line you've packed in. And so it's you can exponentially suppress the probability of the error by increasing your dimension n, the number of different phases, for a given coding line length, for a given range of the variable you want to encode, RL, this smaller range, instead of coding x over the whole range, you truncated the range. So you can either keep the range that you want to code fixed and then increase n beyond that, or you can truncate RL even more and keep n fixed. And those things suppress the probability of those kinds of big threshold errors. But you're absolutely right that in computing mean squared error, you have to take that into account as well, this probability of threshold errors.
Yeah. The statement that you got an exponential mean scaling code, it's really nothing about grid cells. It's about a use of a temporal code.
No.
The space and time. And when you have a temporal code, you get all these extra dimensions. So when you use temporal codes, instead of looking at the range, you look at all the possible intervals between the relative intervals.
Oh, no, so these phases are all spatial phases, right? There's no time in anything I've told you. Everything's rate-based. These phases that I'm talking about are spatial phase. It's because the response of the grid cell is...
You always have a reminder model of lambda, right?
Yeah, that's the spatial phase.
Yeah, but it's time.
I don't think so. I just don't think of. I think temporal computation, temporal representation is just so much more poor. But okay, you could.
Temporal, you have many more dimensions because you're looking at all the possible intervals between every possible spine.
Yeah, but I don't know how to build. I mean, yeah, I just think of all, everything I've told you is purely spatial. So I strongly disagree, though, with the statement that it's temporal rather than.
Grid cell.
It's all about grid cell spatial rate code. In this case, in this story I've told you. But I agree that you could translate all of that into time. But
it requires that the rate matters. Right?
Yeah.
Neuron, the relative differences in rates really matter in your code.
To the same extent that it matters for classical population codes. I'm not demanding anything more from my neurons.
In classical population code, you could set a really crude, you could make these binary neurons and you get the same one over the net.
Yeah.
Right?
In the tuning curve shape, you mean? Yeah. Yeah.
It's, like,
yeah.
It's on or off. Whereas
it's the same thing.
You need to exploit.
No, that's not true.
The continuum of the amplitude.
No, that's just not true.
Because you're winding on this giant path.
Yeah, but because each phase is encoded by m neurons, so there's a population code for each phase.
Yeah.
So,
the exponential gain you gotta be gaining.
The exponential gain you get is from the distinct phases. But the
is the relative amplitudes are changing as you move along this
thing. It's of the phase. The phases are changing, right? But within a given population code, within a given grid cell network, you read out the phase that's encoded from a classical population code. Within a grid cell network, it's just a classical population code. That's what I showed you, right? A given grid cell network is just a continuous attractor network. It has, if you think of it in the space of phases rather than coding for location, you just think about it as coding a phase of this periodic response, it is a single bump code. It's just like a place cell code within a population.
If I can go back to your comment, maybe the deep analogy is the question of being able to look at the system at many different levels of resolution. So this spatial code,
that's right.
To do that, right? Because she's doing x over
multi-scale
lambda for many lambdas.
That's right.
And in a temporal code, when if you were able to look at distance between spikes, so many, you'd also be looking at many different levels of resolution. So I think that's analogy. It's not that this is a temporal code.
No, no,
as in a temporal code, yeah. You are able to look at the system at many levels of resolution.
They're not equivalent mathematics?
One would have to be more careful because I think in a temporal code you would have all levels of resolution. Here you have a finite set of
numbers. That's right.
Well, you have some level of resolution depending on your decoding mechanism.
Right, but you say, okay, I can look at the system at this and this and this and this level of resolution, and that's it. So she's has a discrete number of lambdas, and that's it.
You need the phase resolution, and that you don't get in a temporal code. So, because here you get a whole population of like thousands of neurons coding each phase with high accuracy, or you know, reasonably high accuracy. So, yeah, that's right.
See, that's another thing that's.
I think that's the analogy.
Your idea is that you can have translational invariance along this exponentially long manifold.
That's right, and but you can get it by only building in the translation invariance within each of these small.
Why do you not have corrugation within this?
Well, you always have corrugation to the extent that you've got finite resolution. I mean, in a single classical population code, like single continuous subtractor network, the fact that you've got a finite discrete number of neurons means that you've got corrugation.
Exactly.
It's always
so the corrugation sets the scale. That's
right.
The number of neurons.
Exactly.
Well, why do you get away with
because
I don't know why you don't lose exponential.
No, because that's the amazing thing, right? Because if you look locally, so basically another way to think about this is the following, right? So within a single network, your phase resolution is like 1/1, it's like M, right? Where there are M neurons in the network, your phase resolution within a single network is M, because they're M neurons, okay? So now you take one of those networks, right? So what's a classical population code? You take a single grid network, and you actually put in NM neurons total, okay, into that network, and you make your period RL. M and N are just numbers, okay? Total number of neurons is N times N. So that's the total number of neurons. So what you do is, so that's the total number of neurons, okay, NM, and you put them all in one classical population code network, like just a ring network, okay? And now you take your ring network and you want to encode space that's as big as RL, right? It goes from zero to this exponentially large range. So you take those corrugations, and to make this one ring network code for this whole exponentially large range, you have to take those states, and you have to stretch them over that whole RL range. So you've taken these states that had some corrugation, and you expanded the whole thing so that they can cover this RL. Now what's happening with the grid cell code is you've got N different networks of with M neurons each. Each network has its corrugations, okay? But those corrugations are now each covering only a period lambda, which is, you know, say, of size unity, right? Okay, so lambdas are of size unity. So you're not doing any stretching to make the corrugations big. Those stay. So locally, your Fisher information is exactly the same as before. But for the classical population code to cover an exponentially large range, you have to stretch it. But these ones, you don't have to stretch. It's just you're using the different combinations. You're using this kind of combinatorial sort of fact that they have different periods. So that's the beauty of the scheme, right? So.